sounds of the shofar. The sounds of the shofar. The shofar, the ram's horn, tells us to wake up, get woke, pay attention, be aware, and vote. Yeah, I'm wearing my brand new, I just got it in the mail today, vote necklace from my friend in Portland, who made a few of these necklaces. And she said, I'm wearing mine when I write letters for Vote Forward. I mean, person's got to have jewelry for every occasion, no? So, glad you're awake and you're here at KMUN Astoria, KTCB Tillamook, here for Arts Live and Local. And boy, what a show I've got today. First, I just want to let you know that you can go to the website while you're listening, press the donate button anytime. And a big thanks to the Tenor Guitar Gathering with their generous donation, and Lisa and Jan and Vicky and Imogen. And also, we just heard Crimson and Clover. I got another gift today. It is the time of gift giving. Oh, yeah. Shana Tova. Tonight is the beginning of the Jewish New Year. And, well, I didn't get Crimson and Clover, but I got a fabulous tzimmis. Who'd have think it? Well, tzimmis Tori style. And thank you. Thanks to everyone out there who is gift-giving to one another, whether it's stuff or compassion, mercy. And just remember, miracles do happen. And we know that. Cheryl and I were talking about it. Big get well shout out there. Our friend Joshua. Miracle right there. You want to know more? Talk to me later. Well, speaking of miracles, we have a miracle who lives in our midst. And Dr. Robert Michael Pyle. Are you there, Bob?
Hi, Carol.
Hi. Well, you know, I guess I never thought of you as a shy, bumbling person, but I...
No.
I watched...
All over your eyes all these years, I guess.
I watched the trailer of the brand new movie, The Dark Divide, and I saw that and I went, is that the same Bob Pyle that we know so well and love so well right here in the Columbia Pacific region? So Bob is here because, well, he's always got something going on, and right now he's got three things going on, and we'll talk about the books a little bit later. But right now we want to talk about a brand new movie, The Dark Divide, and it is opening tonight at the Columbian Theater in Astoria, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night, 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:15, and I'll give you the logistics later, but a great big mazel tov, Bob. This is incredibly exciting.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you so much, and happy Rosh Hashanah.
Thank you. Well, I mean, this is not the story of your life. It's only one part of your life, but what a part. So tell us a little bit about, well, Bob is a naturalist, I should say. That's where the Dr. Robert Michael Pyle comes from. And a naturalist, a writer, an author, and the king of the monarch butterflies and beer. I think that's what... Oh, those were birds and beer that you and, yeah.
Yeah, Fayette and I led the birds and beer to Britain one time.
Right.
Yeah.
But this is about a journey across the Gifford Pinchot National Forest in 1995. Is that right?
Correct.
So what prompted it? And did you really spend 6 weeks out there on your own? The opening scene is absolutely hilarious with these guys asking. Well, we should say... Bob is not doing the acting. We have a couple of famous actors in this film. David Cross is playing Bob, and Deborah Messing is playing Tia. So that is Bob's beloved former wife who passed several years ago and is very much a part of the story. But mostly it's your story in the wilderness. So tell us about it and why and what prompted you. How, and you weren't, I mean, that's only 25 years ago. You weren't a child. So what put you out there?
Oh, thank you, Carol. Well, what put me out there and what made the movie happen are two somewhat different but related things. I made the trek in the first place, and yes, I did spend about 6 weeks out there on my own, almost entirely on my own. There were human encounters, of course, which are portrayed in the film. As a result of a Guggenheim Fellowship I received to look into the contemporary and historic power and consequence and meaning of the Bigfoot traditions in all the cultures in the Pacific Northwest. That's the strangest thing. That's the most miraculous thing about this whole operation. I mean, to get a Guggenheim to study Bigfoot, you got to admit, that's the weirdest thing of the entire mission here.
And for the locals, it's also he's also known as Sasquatch.
Correct, so, Sasquatch, yes. Bigfoot, Tsleil-Waututh, Tsleil-Waututh, Oma, all those things. I had a strong interest in that field of study, and particularly how it informed our way of looking at the wild for a long time, and I happened to get this grant to study it. And so that sent me, after my year of formal studies of the subject, into the wilderness for this extended time. And the wilderness I chose is an unprotected wild area, which we will come back to without fail toward the end, called the Dark Divide up in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest. I wasn't looking for Bigfoot, but I was looking for my sense of Bigfoot after these Bigfoot studies with the Native Americans, with the white Bigfoot hunters and the literature and the lore and the tabloids and everything else.
So,
but that book was also about wildness, about the green, much like Wintergreen in a way, except turned toward the Cascades and the remaining old growth and wildlands that we no longer possess in the Willapa Hills, and Bigfoot as a window on wildness. Now, this book was read, and here's one of your miracles still happening, Carol, that this happened and that it finally 10 years later became a movie. That's being released tonight here in Astoria. How exciting. It was always my dream to have it shown at the Columbian, and it is. Well, this book of mine called Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide, currently in print from Counterpoint Press. You can order it through Lucy's or through Godfather's if they are able to reopen, and through Powell's.com or any independent bookstore, and, of course, the other ones, too, but we favor the indies. This was read by a man named Tom Putnam, a filmmaker in L.A., about 10 years ago. And he had grown up not too far from the Dark Divide, and his own youthful experiences were in that kind of territory. And it really brought him back to it, and he remembered how important it was to him and how his life in L.A., in Los Angeles, has felt estranged from the natural world in the way that he knew it when he was up here. And so he read the book, and he was telling him, a friend recommended it to him. And he said, you're going to love the book, but don't think about trying to make a movie out of it. It would be impossible. Tom was known already for a number of very well-received documentaries. He's primarily a documentary filmmaker, though he has made feature films in Hollywood as well. He made one with Paris Hilton. He said she was absolutely charming. The movie wasn't a great one, I gather, experience. But he didn't really like the Hollywood process that much. He went into documentaries, and he made some stunning ones more recently about the Detroit Fire Department, a film called Burn, which is prize-winning, extraordinary film. I can't imagine how it was filmed. But Tom read this book, and he said, well, it probably would be impossible to film, but I'd like to try anyway. So he contacted me. This is now close to 10 years ago. With the question of how would I feel about a movie documentary being made about Where Bigfoot Walks. And I said, well, that'd be pretty cool. I've had experience with film crews doing, you know, there was a Japanese film, the crew that came over and filmed an episode based on it and a few other things, but nobody made a movie of it, as one German filmmaker had made of my my book, Chasing Monarchs, and that was a lot of fun. So I thought, well, yeah, that would be great. So I took it to my agent, and my agent took it to her film department in New York, and they said, well, it's kind of interesting, but it's going to be independent and a documentary, and there's much money involved, so we're not going to be involved either. I said, okay, well, I'll go on my own. And so Tom and I formed our own agreement, and he optioned the film. And he renewed the option every year, which paid a few bills, and I thought, that's great. If it never gets made, at least he was interested. And then about 3 years ago, he really got going on, and he started to get some backing, including the great producer, Jory Weitz, who was the producer of a film that many people know and love called Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, yeah.
And some other good folks, and started putting a little bit of a bankroll together for it. Still indie-sized, you know. And so he started working on the script. And he realized fairly early on that he wanted to make a feature film that was a narrative instead of a documentary. And that involved a certain amount of fictionalization, but we'll get into how much and what kind later on, I hope. But he asked me how I'd feel about that, and I said, well, let me see the script. And he did, and there were some fundamental changes, as is going to happen in absolutely any film.
Right.
But I liked the script, and he let me be, it was very much a collaborative process. I got to
every
draft of the script and change some things and suggest some things. And as the script evolved, even though it contained some pretty radical changes from the book, I was pretty thrilled with it and with his script writing, and it went ahead. Now, flash forward, the movie's made, and let's get back later into a couple of the difficulties in making the movie itself. But let's go now to this late winter and early spring. The film was finished, and it was all set to be released, and the premiere was going to be L.A., and then it was going to be the featured opening night film at the Ashland Film Festival.
Oh, wow.
And I was going, you know, red carpet, cast members, the whole deal. It was going to be the Cinderella moment. Of course, that date was April the 16th. Well, you know, the rest never happened. So for it to be happening now, really 5 months later, but really not that long, and to be in one of the very first flights of live cinemas to be showing it, and it'll be in lots of other cinemas tonight around the country.
Oh, okay.
And lots of virtual cinemas where you buy the film from the movie theater, but it's streamed in your home.
Mm-hmm.
And then also it's available for streaming online at the website, which we'll give you, starting today.
But wait a minute. There's only one place in the world where the subject of the film will be sitting in the audience. Am I right?
Right on.
And that's it.
That's right
here.
So this is our premiere. It's our premiere here. Thanks so much to Janine Fairchild of the Columbian.
Always, yes.
And by the way, everybody who's advertises so nicely, Alyssa, in the newspapers and yourself now on your wonderful program, which I am visiting for about the bazillionth time. And
correct.
You're always so generous to me, and thank you for... And, Carol, what a joy, my darling, to be doing this on the premiere launch day. I mean, I'm beside myself, and to be sharing it with you, or you helping me to share it with our dear friends on the radio.
This is so
and
exciting.
And KMUN is just more than I can express.
Well, and the feedback I got when people saw that you were going to be on the show, first people were writing me and saying, did you hear that Bob Pyle's film is going to be it? And I said, yes, as a matter of fact.
I have an exclusive.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, this is where I wanted to do it. I always pictured having my first viewing of this movie on the big screen at the Columbian, and that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
So how cool is that? Now, of course, I have compunction about going indoors with people.
Right, and that's why
I
checked.
I've never done that. I've been with, you know, six people at the co-op is about the most I've seen in 5 months, like most people.
But I emailed Janine and asked for that very reason. What are the protocols? And she's got, of course, as ever, Janine has a handle on it. And there is a way to, which they never do pre-sales there, but this time there will be because of the situation. So you can go email filmqueen@columbianvoodoo.com. Columbia.com. That's with an N, not the Columbia. That'll take you to Longview, Washington. This is ColumbianVoodoo.com. Or you can give a call, 503-325-3516. And you want to say how many tickets you need and how many COVID bubbles required. So if there are three of you in your party, you get that. And if you have 15 tickets and you want five different separate bubbles, you'll say that. And they'll figure it out and give your phone number. The other thing is, do you want to be in the beer and wine service area, Bob? They couldn't disappoint you and not have the beer there.
So. Well, I'm not going to be in the service area. We're going to have three little family bubbles down front.
I hope you will, yes. So,
and I probably shouldn't drink too much beer anyway, because I'm going to be taking questions and answers from the audience afterwards.
Yeah.
It's a short introduction, and then Florence is going to introduce us to begin the evening, and then I will say a few words of context to start it, and then we'll watch the movie all together, my first time in the big screen and yours, and then afterwards I'll take Q&A for as long as it goes.
So I have a question, though. Mm-hmm. Since you said he'd been thinking of documentary but switched to film, just watching that short trailer, I laughed and I cried during the trailer.
Yeah, the masterpiece of a trailer, wasn't it? I think one of the best trailers I've ever seen.
So now, is that all? I mean, somebody reading the book, and you are a fabulous writer at bring everything alive, even to folks like me who knew so little. You go into such detail in the natural world and do it so well that we get sucked right into it. But
yeah, the reviewer for the New York Times Book Review, and this was my first book ever reviewed in the New York Times Book Review, it was a pretty decent review, but he said, sometimes you can't see the pines for the pipsissewas. I think he was kind of criticizing me for as much detail of the natural world as there is. I said, well, I'm sorry. Forgive me for writing a nature book, you know. But anyway, yes, there is a good deal of actual physical detail of the land, but it's secondary to the story.
Absolutely. So, there are some hilarious scenes. I think the funniest, of course, is the guy being you running across in your underwear. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, and that's true, and there were some scenes in the book with less on than that, but
I see.
There's only one of those in the movie, and it's not an embarrassing one, it's a sweet one.
No, it's sweet. It's
would you like me to say just a word about how the story diverges from the book?
Yes, please.
Oh, it's a strange thing, as you can imagine. Well, I'll ask myself, say, Bob, how does it feel to have yourself portrayed in a movie? Well, Bob, it's weird, it's odd, it's strange, it's intense.
And it's wonderful.
Fabulous. It's awesome in the strict sense of the word. And most of all, it's humbling by this by this caliber of cast. And the entire cast is stunning. I'll come back to them. But absolutely wonderful. But the strange thing about it is, to see your story and your life portrayed and translated into a different form of art, and I think a high form of art is a good movie in my view, not because it concerns me, but because Tom's a wonderful filmmaker and he was working with a crack crew, though lean, and a superb cast. But the weird thing is to see that happen with your work. Now, there are a lot of writers who have not been happy. I mean, three of my dear friends, I will not name them, but they're well-known writers. Everybody would know their names and their books probably, at least a lot of your listeners would. They vie with one another for whose novel was made into the worst movie in history.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
And I'm glad to say I don't have that feeling at all. I feel quite thrilled with how it came out. But also, even Ken Kesey wasn't fully happy with Sometimes a Great Notion. The Cuckoo's Nest. Part of that was because, of course, it was Jack Nicholson, and Paul Newman got the recognition rather than Ken Kesey. But, you know, nobody's going to be completely happy. You can't take the masterpiece of Northwest fiction, which is, in my view, Sometimes a Great Notion, and turn it into a less than two-hour movie and expect it to contain everything. Mm-hmm. Of course, especially when Paul Newman was drunk during the entire thing, as we know from Matt Love's book.
Right. Matt Love did a beautiful job on that.
Oh, Matt did a beautiful job. I love that book.
But you're content.
There is going
content.
To be some change in life. And so when people view this tonight, the number of the people present will know me and will have known Tia.
Right.
And they're going to be surprised in some respects. And they're going to say, what? That wasn't like that. And that didn't happen at that time. And you are not like that. Well, the filmmaker and the writer has to have some room to shuck and jive to make the narrative work for the story's throughput, you know, in an hour and a half. And the cast has to have some room for their own abilities to expand. And so there are various reasons for some fictional changes. But let me say this first. Every single episode in the movie, with possibly one or two tiny exceptions, are actually based on episodes in the book and in my real life from this book and from six. Tom consulted seven of my books for this. I don't mean consulted.
Beautiful.
He employed, he translated parts from seven of my books, including the poetry. This is also a grief story, very much a grief story, and that came out of my grief poems for Tia in my book, Chinook and Chanterelle. So Tom made a remarkable metamorphosis of my material into this movie from different sources. The main three things that people will notice that are quite different from how it actually happened in the Cartesian world is the timing.
Yes, that's what I noticed. Yeah.
And of course, Tia's illness and death were moved forward in time in order that my trek might correspond with my grief process after Tia died. And that, of course, was tough for me to take at first, you know, monkey in with the actual timeline of my dear late wife's life. But it was done with such respect and such love, and it is conveyed with such extraordinary power and sensitivity by Deborah Messing, who's a master actor and a real sweetheart, too, by the way, and a great socially engaged person, as is David Cross. That makes me very happy. Well, it's done so well that I was okay with it. It's okay, and you'll see that's all in service to the story, makes it even stronger. And those, it's all real. It's all real out of our lives. It's just, you know, put together slightly differently. The second thing that's quite different is it becomes primarily a butterfly trek, not a Bigfoot trek.
Yeah, and the Lopo.
Bigfoot studies. In the movie, I get the Guggenheim for butterfly studies. But that's not wildly unrealistic because I do publish peer-reviewed papers about butterfly science, and I do go out in the woods for butterflies a lot.
Yeah.
It's been a major thing, and I have had grants for it. So it's just translated that way, and I think that was brilliant because otherwise we'd come across as just another Bigfoot movie, and you can imagine the reception it would get. We would not be getting the critical attention that the movie's getting right now if it were thought to be, you know, an outright Bigfoot movie, because not very many of those have been very good. And then the it's much more a movie about wildness, about my trek, about grief and Tia's passage from this life, and about the Native Americans and the loggers and the conservationists and working together, not working together in the movie, but finding common ground. It's about all those different subjects. Tom was able to bring those out in a genius way through changing a few things. The third thing that somewhat changed, yes, Carol, is my character to some degree. I do go into the woods as a doofus, practiced, naive, a tyro, not much of a woodsman.
Right.
I come out a lot better, and I gain in confidence, and I gain in experience, and I gain in acumen out there. Well, that was very clever. Yeah, I was a decent woodsman when I went in, and I was better when I came out, but that doesn't make much of a story.
Yeah.
But you see, this way,
it's more dramatic.
For the character to grow, which is the living center of every piece of fiction and every good movie. The characters have got to grow, and David had to have some room to do that. You know, he's best known as one of the most brilliant comics in the country, but he's also a very good dramatic actor. He played Allen Ginsberg talking with Bob Dylan in the wonderful movie I'm Not There. Well, he had to have some room for his dramatic chops, but also for his comic chops.
Yeah.
And of course, making me a bit of a fool is not entirely out of character by any means, and it gives David some room to work in that regard, and I just laugh at everybody else, so that's cool.
Well, I know, I don't know about the rest of the world that's going to be watching, but I know that the audience this weekend here in Astoria at the Columbian Theater, which is right on the corner of 11th and Marine Drive, 1102 Marine Drive, Astoria, and doors open at 6:15. I know this local audience is going to be roaring at some of it. And then, as I say, it's brought some tears as well. We don't have too much time. I wanted to give you a chance to, and by the way, give us the name of the book, the original book, Where Bigfoot Walks, yeah.
Crossing the Dark Divide.
Right.
And I think is that Dark Divide, I think the cool name, the Dark Divide, which is the real name of the real place, I think that's why I got the Guggenheim, I think that's why I got the book contract. Probably why Tom got interested in the book was because of that very cool name, the Dark Divide, because think about it.
Yeah.
It can be the divide between belief and non-belief, between the physical world and the spiritual world, between life and death, between any two things you want, or between, and this, Carol, let me say, these are ragged times for all of us, not just because of the germ, but because of the terrible, terrible injustices we see around us and the heroic attempts to come to terms with that yet again. And we weep at it, and we're tired of it, and that makes us feel guilty, and we want some redemption and some joy. And
amen.
I frankly hope very much that this film will bring that for people, because ultimately it's a film of celebration. But when you think about how we need to come together, and when you think about how separated things have been, that's where I hope this film will fill a gap in some people's lives, at least for the evening at the movies.
Absolutely. Well, and carry it out, and carry it out with us.
Carry it out, exactly.
It's, we all need some miracles, inspirations, and all of this. So again, this is this evening, 7 o'clock at the Columbian Theater, tomorrow evening and Sunday evening, and who knows, maybe we'll get Bob to come back another weekend as well.
Yeah, we're actually talking about that. If the demand continues, we may continue another weekend. I might come back to the theater again. Tomorrow night, I actually get to see it again up in Morton, Washington, which is a cool little town that's right on the edge of the Dark Divide.
Oh,
so it's wonderful that it's premiering there, too, and it's going to be in a great old restored movie house called the Roxy Theater. You can go online and buy advance tickets. So if anybody can't go tonight here or the other two nights, they could take a little field trip up to Morton and buy tickets in advance if you're going to drive that far.
And remember, Bob, there are
the
people...
The Roxy Theater, and it's going to be Friday, Saturday, and Monday nights up there.
And there are people listening to this show all over the world.
That's
so
right,
they might be...
in New York and
so check out...
Romania and everywhere.
Check out the... check out the movie. What is the website?
Get it in Tasmania or Staten Island. Go to the website Dark Divide Film, all one word, lowercase, darkdividefilm.com.
Okay.
Go to that. You can click for the trailer, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
And you can click for the thing that says get tickets, and it will tell you ways to watch the movie everywhere. Now, it's going to be in theaters, virtual cinemas, and then you can also... get the movie online streaming from the website, from REI, which is one of the big sponsors, and from various other sources. But
nice.
It's going to go into the normal streaming platforms not until November, and then there will be DVDs available probably in December. But for now,
do it now.
Website, and you can find a way to watch this movie as of today.
Okay, now, before I let you go, I do want to give a quick run on your new book. You have two new books coming, but the one
that's out this month. Everything's happened for me this month.
This is a big month. Well,
it's a big month.
Well, it's
having way too much fun this month.
God, it's in preparation for big changes that are coming. We hope so. We're making them happen. So the book that I read about that's going to be featured at the Columbia River Maritime Museum, as well as everywhere else, The Tidewater Reach, Your Poetry, Dr. Robert Michael Pyle Poetry, with photography by Judy Vandermaiden.
Vandermaiden of Cathlamet, my favorite photographer.
Absolutely.
One of my favorite photographers, yes.
I have to give a shout out to the fact that both of you you were our keynote speaker, and Judy was one of the key photographers for Spirit of the River, which Cheryl and I put those on with a huge volunteer mass from this
that's
area.
Right. You're responsible for this book because that's the night that Judy, whose pictures I already was collecting a little bit, asked me if I ever wanted to collaborate on a book.
Wow.
I didn't think so because my books are made out of page pictures that I write, and I never saw the need. But with Judy, whose pictures I absolutely love,
fabulous.
I said, yeah, maybe so. Yeah. So for some years, that marvelous Spirit of the River, we have been working on this book, and we finally found a publisher, which is the wonderful Columbia River Reader Press. If people know the Columbia River Reader, the free monthly out of Longview, that's going to be more and more available in Astoria now. It's a sweet little book. It'll be at the River Sea Gallery and at the Maritime Museum to start with.
Good. So, and that, by the way, folks who don't know or listening somewhere else, Spirit of the River was for a benefit for the Columbia River Keeper when we were fighting to protect the Columbia River from liquefied natural gas. So it all ties together. Now, quick word, you have another book coming out, Nature Matrix.
The publication day was Wednesday. I'm telling you, Carol, this is all happening right now.
What is
it's
Nature
Matrix? I'm 73 years old. It's about time this stuff. But it's all happening this week. So this is yes, thank you. Sorry to interrupt you, but I know your time is short. This book is called Nature Matrix, New and Selected Essays. And it's from Counterpoint Press, the same publisher as I've been working with for several books now, and they brought out my novel, Magdalena Mountain, which you and I talked about last year, and it's a beautiful book, but it contains, I think, 16 essays, five of them new, and some of them going back a ways. One of them I wrote 50 years ago at the University of Washington, actually two of them I did, and they were going to be in a book called Nature Matrix that I first put together in 1970. But fortunately, it wasn't published because, it was pretty premature.
Yeah.
50 years later, that book has actually come together. Two of those pieces are in that book, and they were both published online this week. First one's called Mineral King Aesthetic. That's at terrain.org. And the second one is called, it's about the great heaths of Northern Europe and my having my eyes open and radicalized as an environmentalist. It's about heather and tanks on the land.
Quick.
And that's published today, actually, in lithub.com.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. Is there anywhere, do you have your own website?
You know, I have dear friends here in town who help me with things, and one of those is Victoria Sage, Tori Sage, and she is helping me with a bunch of things right now, and one of them is she's finally going to help me develop a website.
All right. Thank you, Tori, and thank you for her mother, the
yes,
fabulous poet, Florence Sage.
So
here you go, folks. Check this out. Go to thedarkdividefilm.com and watch the trailer. Enjoy it. And I know you'll want to see the movie. And a huge congratulations, Bob. This is incredibly exciting.
Thank you, Carol. I can't tell you how honored I am to be portrayed by the great actor David Cross, and to see Tia portrayed by Deborah Messing is one of the most stirring things in my life. So for people to share that with us tonight and any time at all in heart will be dear to me. And I want to wish everyone a great big salud and also a pax. That's PAX, by the way.
Oh, dear. Be careful.
That was possibly not the most graceful thing to say. And also, I want to say thank you, Carol, and thanks to everybody involved in bringing this thing into the world. I'm a very, very lucky lad.
And we are all very lucky to be here together. What a community we have. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, KMUN.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
KMUN Astoria, KTCB Tillamook. This is Arts Live and Local. You were listening to Dr. Robert Michael Pyle. And there's so much. There's so much to realize. Film Queen at ColumbianVoodoo.com or 503-325-3516. leave your phone number and how many tickets, how many pods, what area you want to be in, and celebrate our community. And celebrate your community radio station while you're at it at coastradio.org. Thanks, folks. That's Pete Seeger, of course, who took the lines from Ecclesiastes, turn, turn, turn. And you may have heard the line, refrain from embracing, time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. Well, we seem to be in it right now, although we still have our pods. And we also started that Pete Seeger little medley with If I Had a Hammer, and that goes back to something that my guest last week, Garland Kirkpatrick, said. Actually, he used it. It comes from Bertolt Brecht. Art is not a mirror held up to reality, but a hammer with which to shape it. And he does that in his work. And clearly, Pete Seeger has done that all his life. And it is the Jewish New Year beginning tonight, and I am hoping that everyone is able to do some contemplation and think about renewing what needs to be renewed. And we all know some of those things. Well, I have two, not one, but two fabulous authors here who have renewed themselves by publishing new books. So, Apricot Irving, hello.
Hello, thanks so much for having us.
You bet. I am delighted. You and I have not met in person, but I look forward to that time. And I understand that you have your brand new book, The Gospel of Trees, a memoir. So when we say memoir, I know there's been a lot of writing about that recently, so I want you to be able to talk a bit about that. First, let me introduce our other guest, Deborah Reed. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
You bet. Deborah has been on Coast, actually on Arts Live and Local before, and mm-hmm. We're going to talk to Deborah, who also has a new book coming out. But right now, the two of them are going to be involved in a conversation. Conversation of authors, and this is sponsored by the Manzanita. Where am I looking here? I've had them on the show many times as well.
The Manzanita Writers Series.
The Writers Series. Thank mm-hmm. you. It couldn't be more simple. So this is going to be Zoomed. You do need to make reservations. So let's listen to Apricot and Deborah, and you'll be inspired, I'm sure, to join them. First, I just want to check in with you, Apricot. I've misstated your name several times, and finally, I'm giving you a chance to tell us, is that your real name?
That is my real name. So I was born a redhead, I still am one, and my parents weren't expecting red hair, although they both have cousins on either side of the family. And so who knows why they had the idea of the name Apricot. Originally, I'm told as a middle name, but uh-huh. when I was born with hair of this color, they just both looked at each other and said, It was meant to be. This is her name. So I've been Apricot my entire life.
It's a gorgeous name. Have you ever met another Apricot?
Not yet. I used to imagine that we'd like be in the grocery store checkout aisle together, and the person ahead of me would be signing her name, and I'd be like, "You're an Apricot." That hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Well, good luck. So, if anybody out there is listening and knows somebody named Apricot, please do report in, and we'll
Can
give you
say
some.
Another funny thing, like I used to teach in Indonesia when I was in my early 20s, mm-hmm. and I met someone from Oregon. that told me that there was another apricot from Portland, Oregon that they had heard of but never met. And I was like, it's me. It's got to be me.
It's
got to
be you. No, it's got to be you. So I have something to share with you because I did read that you were born in Haiti? Were you your parents?
No,
were
no.
There?
Okay. My parents moved there when I was 6 years old.
Six.
And
okay.
We were there and back until I was 15.
Okay. So your parents, you are the daughter of missionaries. And I need to tell you something, because when you say that word slowly, the first syllable is mish. And actually, the word for apricot in Hebrew is, you ready? Mish. Did you know
it's
that?
It's the same in Arabic.
Right? That would make sense.
Yeah.
That would make sense. The two languages come together. The first fruit that I picked on trees in 1966 or 65 were apricots on a kibbutz. And I was told the name was Mishmish. Now, it spelled a little bit Mishmash, but everybody says Mishmish. And so when I heard your name, I immediately went there. And there's more to that story.
What a beautiful image.
But it is. Well, and you are too. I can't wait to meet you. But people will be able to meet you through your work. And the Gospel of Trees seems to be related very much to your father's work in Haiti during this time of upheaval. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, my dad is a farmer. He's third generation. I have cousins now fourth generation date farmers down the Coachella Valley in California. And so he actually came up to Oregon to get his degree in agriculture in the 70s, and that's where I was born, in the Willamette Valley. And he grew organic vegetables in the desert. In the off-season, when he wasn't working on the date farm, he worked as a ranger up in the mountains in California for the Forest Service and the state park. And then he got recruited when I was six to go and run this agricultural center in the north of Haiti. And then we just kept going back. He loved it so much because here was an entire country where there was such a sense of urgency around planting trees, with the deforestation and torrential rainstorms that could wash away the topsoil and drown the coral reef. It really felt like planting trees and helping people grow plants in their garden that could help sustain their families and provide enough cash income, that anything he knew that pertained to any of these subjects really had a significant impact on these communities where we lived. And so for my dad, it was a sense of purpose, like, oh, here I know something that can be of help to people.
Right. However, it wasn't as smooth sailing as it should be.
Yeah,
I think that's a rather complicated story, which is in good part a basis of your book, I understand. I just want to read this one sentence that is in the that I took from the web. In your book, The Gospel of Trees, and Deborah Reed's upcoming novel, Pale Morning Light with Violet Swan, novel of a life in art, they both contemplate the role of beauty in navigating loss and explore what it means to face unresolved family stories in order to bring art into the world. Now, that is a very packed sentence. There's a lot of information there. Is that, would you say, is that, does that make sense to you? Does that ring true?
It definitely rings true.
Definitely.
Deborah's beautiful book, which I'm so excited for one to get to read soon. I got to read an early version, and it was just beautiful to sit with this character who is an artist and watch her, through a fictional life on the page, evoke these same struggles to take in and hold all the complicated layers of what it is to live in the world and to try to love people and to do it badly often and to hurt those we love, and yet to try to work through all of that tangle of family drama and disappointment and longing and unspoken, and reach a place where we can see each other in more complexity and understand each other and maybe see the whole. Mm-hmm. Would you say, Deborah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a perfect description. Apricot and I have had many conversations about this sort of this phenomenon of finding beauty in the middle of so much darkness, and mm-hmm. now here we are in this collective darkness.
Absolutely.
That we're all experiencing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels ever more important to
essential.
Discuss
yeah.
This topic of what do you do with this? Where mm-hmm. do you take this? How do you create something in the midst of this, get mm-hmm. on the other side of it, and what is your legacy? You know, what are you going to leave behind mm-hmm. once mm-hmm. this is passed? Because it will pass, like all darkness and trauma and difficult periods. And so there is that symmetry in my novel and in Apricot's memoir, which is Apricot's life, the struggles within a, you know, the micro struggles within a family, and then how that reverberates from the family to the community to the world, and how each person within their own lives creates, you know, either something beautiful that, you know, and that becomes your legacy, or not. And parenthood is also something mm-hmm. that
yeah.
Rings strongly in both of these stories of how you struggle to be an artist or be someone who is giving to your community while at the same time do your children suffer?
Mm-hmm.
Are you mm-hmm. absent mm-hmm. As you mm-hmm. give to your art or your community
or whatever your art is, it may be, as we're talking here, it may be the arts, whether it's writing or painting mm-hmm. or dancing, music, or it may be the creative area in which you deal in saving lives in some way or another. But how it all, you know, that relates back to what Bob was saying in his book, or which now is the movie, is in the trailer. It shows Tia saying, no, go, you need to go. And even though she was dying. And so that's a bit manufactured, but it's still the concept mm-hmm. of the sacrifices that people make because they have to in order to find the strength to move on and to move ahead and to bring us all together. So now, did you two know each other before?
We've known each other for maybe 10 years or so.
Okay.
We actually met at the writer Natalie Serber's home at a dinner party. Natalie had invited a group of women writers, and I was living in Portland at the time. I'm not sure, Apricot, if you were also living in Portland at the time.
I think I was, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we met that evening and have remained friends ever since.
Right. But here you are. Deborah wrote a novel and Apricot a memoir. And would you say, because I have been reading questions about what is a memoir, what's the purpose of it, and how close to the actual actuality of life is it? How about yours?
Oh, well, memoir is a pretty broad category. So I imagine there are memoirs mm-hmm. that use composite characters and mm-hmm. Take larger themes and kind of represent them in a more fictional way. My approach was very literal. So
okay.
I received boxes and boxes and boxes, hundreds of pages of letters and cassette tapes and newsletters from not just my family, but other missionary families. And so I spent 15 years going through, and then my book is only actually probably one-third memoir, so that's my story and my memory and trying to weave in my own point of view, and I use my journals from those ages to reconstruct that, conversations that I recorded at the time, my parents' letters. Both of my parents ended up giving me their journals, When I was in the process of writing this, my parents and I had hundreds of hours of conversations, and they read many drafts of the book. So about another third of it is my parents' point of view and their inner world. But every time I would write about that, I'd run that past them and rewrite it multiple times until we agreed that it was an accurate representation inner world.
I was going to ask, are they still living, and what did they think about what you wrote? But clearly, they were part of the process, so good for you.
They were very much a part
That's
of the
hard.
Process. It was not easy.
That's hard.
Because every family that I've ever met has the stories that you don't talk about.
Right, absolutely.
Katie was the story that we did not talk about for 10 years after we left, from when I was 15 to when I was 25 and started writing it.
Yeah.
And I asked if we had anything that like we might have saved from our Haiti years, and my mom was like, I don't know, why we would have kept any of that? And my dad's like, let me take you out to the barn. So
he pulled out these mildewed
boxes full of his journals and the cassette tapes and our kid Barbie dolls like when I was 8 years old, flown in on the missionary plane with the one eye that still blinked shut. You know? It was so crazy to have all that across my living room floor, newly married, 26, like trying to face all this for the first time.
And
it wasn't just our family story, because it was also this larger tangle of colonizations and the history of missions and its entanglement with colonizations. And so I ended up going back to Haiti multiple times. I went once for the radio program This American Life just after the earthquake and interviewed people, brought back 60 hours of tape that we condensed into 15 minutes. I interviewed so many people. The other third of the book is that it's reportage, and it's looking at the history and trying to weave all of these really hard questions together, because we went as well-meaning people trying to make the world a better place.
Right.
We also did considerable harm, and it's possible to do a lot of harm as well-meaning white people without realizing the impact of our actions on others.
Yeah, I know that that was one of the big questions with the Peace Corps, and of going in there with a kind heart, compassionate, not realizing how cruel it can be. So I do want to let folks know a little bit of your background, because you have quite a number of awards. You've been the recipient of the Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and Literary Arts Creative Nonfiction Fellowship, and your writing has appeared in Granta, On Being, Tin House, Oregon Humanities, one of my favorites, Portland Monthly, and Topic Magazine. And you've taught literature and writing to students in Indonesia, China, the U.S., the U.K., and Ireland, and reported on post-earthquake recovery efforts in the north of Haiti for This American Life, which you just mentioned. Also the founder and director of the Boise Voices Oral History Project. That makes sense with youth and elders, considering your own background, what you went through, of pulling all this together. You are a queen of oral history, so good that you put that together to record the stories of the rapidly changing neighborhood in North Northeast Portland. Honored at City Hall for civic engagement. And you're in the Gorge now, is that where you live?
That's right. And, you know, it really struck me just now in our conversation. So right now we are all in the midst of a pandemic and then wildfires and one crisis and heartache after another.
Yeah.
I was realizing, Deborah, that the first time that I came out and stayed with you here on the coast in Manzanita was after the Eagle Creek fire. The friends that reached out and said, please, if you need a place to stay, come. Here we are. We have a room, because I was back when we could still stay in each other's homes. And it was such a gift to me. I remember it was after the fires had finally gone out, which, you know, it's going to take a while here again now. The rain is the only thing that can put out fires of this size. You invited me to come and stay in your home. And I remember it was such a gift and a consolation to get up and walk down to the ocean and breathe clean air.
Here we are again.
Novel, there's also this natural disaster that frames
Events
of your novel.
And we're going to talk. I should let folks know the reason I'm not giving Deborah much of a chance to talk is that she's coming back next month.
Yeah, oh, good.
And we will then go into depth. Deborah has been here before. She is a fabulous writer, and you can find her at Cloud and Leaf Bookstore, an independent bookstore, our favorite kind, in Manzanita. So you will hear more from and about Deborah and her new book, as well as all of her other books. So, you know, when you're talking about the compassion and the friendship that was offered, that's a lot of what's happening now. Thank goodness. People are coming to the fore and reaching out to one another. It's stymied by the virus, but people are still making it happen. So thank you so much. Congratulations, Deborah and Apricot, right now.
Thank
this
you.
Is your moment. Mm-hmm. Apricot Irving and Deborah Reed, do you have contact? Do you have websites, either of you? And then I've got to let you go. So if you...
Well, one of the things I wanted to mention is HoffmanArts.org to register for the Zoom conversation.
Yes,
that
thank
we're going
you.
To have tomorrow
yes.
at 4 p.m.
Yes.
You do have to register, and the proceeds go toward the Center for the Arts, which has taken a big hit from COVID. And you can, like, you know, I'm owner of Cloud Leaf Bookstore. You can always find me through the bookstore online. And then Apricot, you go ahead.
Yeah, apricotirving.com is my website for anyone who wants to listen to those amazing oral history conversations. They're so delightful.
Nice and easy. And HoffmanArts.org. is the website. You'll go to their blog. You can find out all kinds of things about the Hoffman Center for the Arts. They were here in August. Fabulous place. Thank you so much to both of you for coming in.
Thanks for
right
having
here.
Us.
KMUN.
Thank you for having us.
You bet.
Thank you so much.
KMUN Astoria, KTCB Tillamook. I do want to mention to folks that tonight, if you're not at the Columbian Theater on 11th and Marine Drive to see Bob Pyle, sort of, in The Dark Divide, you can also, if you want to see a movie, be at the Liberty Theater. They're continuing their series Friday and Saturday, Friday night at 7, Saturday 4 to 6. So you can go to all the movies. Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. There are only 50 tickets going, so you have to go to libertyastoria.org. And speaking of the Hoffman, from 1 to 5, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, they're open with Ron Van Dungen's photography, and there is an art raffle for his work. And here's where I wrote it down. Saturday, HoffmanArts.org/calendars. You can sign up for what we were just talking about with Apricot and Deborah. And tomorrow, the Cannon Beach Library is at 2 o'clock, Northwest Authors virtual series with Paula Butterfield. And Sunday is the Railroad Preservation Association, and there's a chauffeur blowing in Portland. Thanks for being here, folks. Stay tuned. In Progress.